I am recording now, my friends. Mr. Merlob, are you good?
I'm good to go.
Okay. And we're back. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Flicks of Doom, the podcast that takes 6 months off between episodes. Thank you for staying subscribed, anybody who did during that hiatus period, and thank you for the new subscribers as well. We're going to have a little bit of a different format going forward. Empress Eve, unfortunately, due to scheduling conflicts, will not be joining us. Hopefully, from time to time, we can get her on. But we have two new Geeks of Doomers, Mr. Michael Merlob.
Hello, everyone.
And Mr. Will Melton.
Hey, what's up?
And so, as kind of an introduction to these two new Geeks of Doomers, I wanted to ask each of them what their top five favorite films are, because I think you can tell a lot about a person by what their favorite films are, or what they list as their top five. So, let's start off with Mr. Michael Merlob. What is your top five, my friend?
Well, the actual order of this top five tends to switch around sometimes, so I'll just kind of run through the list as I just wrote it down today. And my top five is Raiders of the Lost Ark, Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia, A Clockwork Orange, Taxi Driver, and finally David Lean's epic masterpiece, Lawrence of Arabia.
Excellent. All excellent selections, and hopefully you can tell a little bit more about, get an insight into Mr. Merlob from that list, my friends.
That's right. I like Raping Women and the Desert.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Mr. Melton, I know you were having a little bit of trouble with your list a little bit earlier. Have you come to a decisive top five?
Well, what I did is I picked five films that I think will, you know, give an idea about what I watch. I'm really indecisive when it comes to favorite films. You know, I could probably do like top five zombie movies or top five spaghetti westerns, but overall, I'm such a mood oriented person, you know, or indecisive, however you want to look at it, that it's difficult. So the five I picked, 28 Days Later, Mean Streets, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, American Beauty, and Pulp Fiction.
Excellent. Excellent. All excellent films as well, Mr. Melton. And if anyone's curious to buy top five, it is Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, the first Back to the Future, Empire Strikes Back, Dark Knight, and Shaun of the Dead. Hopefully you can get a little bit of insight into myself as well.
All great films.
Yeah. So now that the introductions are out of the way, my friends, let's just talk about what we would normally talk about outside of the podcast. But let's just record it now and talk about what's been on our minds film-wise. We had talked in an email a while back when this was announced. There's this new movie pass that's in beta right now, and Mr. Melton had some interesting thoughts on it, and Mr. Merlob agreed with most of those thoughts, but I just wanted to share with the listeners here. If you're not familiar, MoviePass is this new $50 a month service for film fans, and it lets you subscribe, basically almost like a Netflix type of model for watching movies in the theater. So you can watch unlimited movies in the theater using your smartphone as a ticket, and MoviePass is going to let you search for a film, find a showtime, check into the theater, and then go straight to the ticket taker. So it's been kind of in a private beta starting in San Francisco, and I guess they were trying to move forward, but they had canceled it in some areas. But what do we think about this? Since Mr. Melton was so outspoken about this, what do you think about a $50 a month unlimited movie pass?
I think it's insane, and it shows how out of touch the movie industry is and why their business is failing. I mean, that's $600 a year. Seriously, $600. I mean, by comparison, if you get Netflix Instant View, it's just under $120 a year. It's like $9 a month. I mean, that's that's quite a markup. And, you know, in order, if you got to think, most movie tickets are, you know, $8 to $10. You're going to have to see 5 to 6 movies a month just to break even. 7 to profit on this investment. And, you know, that might be a good deal if it included the 3D movies, since those cost so much. But no, you have to pay an extra $3 surcharge for every 3D film you see. So you're not going to save money on that front. And as far as I remember, you're not allowed to see the same movie twice. So you can't go, oh, I really love Inception, I'm going to go back 2 or 3 times and try and figure out what's really going on. Once you've seen it, you know, that's that. You know, so it doesn't really provide anything of benefit. It's just a bundle deal to kind of disguise the fact that you're going to pay up more than you would probably pay if you just went to the movies and bought the tickets. I mean, even at $10 a ticket, it's 5 movies a month just to cover what you pay, and that's 60 movies a year. I'm sorry, Hollywood doesn't make 60 movies a year I want to go pay for. I mean, we get to go to free movie screenings, and I don't go see that many movies. Yeah. I'm not going to pay $600 a year to see if I can make it work.
Yeah, it's something that you have to be a really hardcore cinema watcher. Like, you have to go see Zookeeper and the latest whatever Adam Sandler comedy, the latest Tyler Perry. Like, you have to be interested in every single new release. That's the only way I could see you seeing 5 or 6 movies a month. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's definitely a strange thing that they think that there's a big enough audience out there of people who are going to see that many movies, or think that that's a good value for that price. It's very strange to me.
I mean, the only people I could see really taking advantage of it are, say, parents during the summer, just get their kids like 3 months worth of movie passes so they can get them out of the house.
Yeah.
But even then, there's going to be a limited option, you know, unless they're over, you know, 13.
Yeah, there's only so many.
Yeah.
Either kids movies or, like you said, for young adult movies that they'd be interested in.
Yeah. And
not only that, but it looks like if there's a 3D or IMAX film, they're going to put a surcharge on top of that price.
It's a $3 surcharge.
Yeah. So very strange who they're trying to attract with this offer. Michael, I guess people who, if you want to combine the indie movies with the latest blockbuster, if you're that type of person who likes to just see everything, I guess that's who they're trying to aim at. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I think Will put it pretty succinctly. I just don't think there's a sizable audience for something like this. I think there are people out there for whom this would make sense, but in terms of, you know, the average person, I think they're grossly overestimating how much people really give a crap about movies.
Yeah.
As much as that pains me to say, because I wish everyone loved movies as much as the three of us did. And I think maybe even for the three of us, at some point, something like that would make economic sense. But $50 a month, just, you know, that's a daunting number for anything. I mean, that's like getting to the range where we pay for digital cable and stuff like that. And it's just very tough to entice people to spend money like that up front. And then in addition to which, they still have to get to the theater, pay for the parking, pay for the food, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't present a substantial enough value, leaving aside the fact that most people just don't go to the movies that often.
Yeah.
Now, if each movie came with like a free medium popcorn and soda,
then you'd be talking.
Yeah. But I mean, come on. Seriously. And you know, I like what Justin said, the idea of, you know, having the combination of the Hollywood and the indie films. I think if that was the case, I might be able to pull, you know, easily 6 to 7 movies a month. But, you know, I don't know of any theater that really gives you both options. You know, you either have like your landmark theaters that have the foreign and the indie and the documentary, or you have, you know, your chain theaters that have, you know, the Hollywood movies. But I don't know of any that really offers both.
Yeah. And I think that's where this, for the service to take advantage of multiple theaters, and I think people who are in places like New York, where the movie prices or the tickets are upwards of $15 to $20, something like that, I think that those are the two times I would say the two audiences that would be interested. People who live in cities where the tickets prices are pretty expensive, because for someone like me, I'm in Arizona, and Monday through you know, during the week, I can see movies for $5. And then the matinee is like $7, and then it goes up from there. But that, for me, right there, wouldn't be a very good value. And then for people who have access to multiple theaters playing those type of indie films that mm-hmm. you wouldn't see in, I don't know, Lincoln, Nebraska or whatever. So those are the two audiences they would probably have to go at. And it's just, it doesn't seem like that audience is big enough to sustain this. So that's very strange. But we had a good talk through email, and I thought I wanted to share it for our first episode here on Flicks of Doom. So, Mr. Melton and Mr. Merlob, anything tingling your spider senses in the world of movies?
Honestly, no. I mean, I think Mr. Merlob is possibly in the same place. I'm so hyped for Comic-Con next week that it's really taken over. That's pretty much the main thing on my mind right now. I did watch a few movies this week, but...
What are you guys looking forward to at Comic-Con? I know, I heard Amazing Spider-Man is going to have some type of presence there. That's something that I'm excited about, to hear any type of information for that. And then, are they doing a Captain America screening there, or have you guys heard anything?
About Captain America, no. I think Cowboys and Aliens, showing.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, that's what it was, Cowboys and Aliens.
Which, by the way, if we want to talk about that for a second, Cowboys and Aliens is apparently tracking very badly right now.
Oh, no.
And based on, if you sort of aggregate the number of Twitter comments on a movie like Cowboys versus Aliens versus something like, say, Transformers, it's coming in way, way, way behind. I mean, it's more of an original property than Transformers, so that would be natural, but it's the bubble on that movie is quite small when you look at the quantity of comments, which kind of does not bode well for the kind of buzz on the movie. It just sort of seems like people aren't that interested in it. But Comic-Con, you know, if there's any place to debut a movie like that, it's Comic-Con. But then again, as we've seen in the past, Comic-Con is by no means a barometer for a mainstream audience. So just take a look at Scott Pilgrim and how that movie fared after having a smashing debut there.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's been a lot of huge trailers that have come out in the last week that's maybe worth talking about. Well, Justin, you don't watch trailers, do you?
That is correct. Unless it's a teaser trailer, which I did watch the Dark Knight Rises teaser before Harry Potter.
But what did you think of that one?
I thought it was interesting that it kind of just confirmed what a lot of people have been speculating of. It's going to be heavily, there's going to be a heavy contribution of this being the wrap-up of the arc that Christopher Nolan started mm-hmm. in Batman Begins. And so I think Ra's al Ghul and kind of that whole storyline that we started in the first one, there's going to be some type of presence. That's what it seemed like from the teaser trailer.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I'm very curious to see who Gordon was talking to from his hospital bed there. But I enjoyed it.
How about you, Will?
I really liked the trailer, too. And I think, you know, everything Justin just said, you know, is on point. You know, it confirms a lot of the suspicions that we had about the storyline. I love that first movie poster they released, you know, with the city crumbling, yeah, the skyline kind of forming the bad signal. I mean, aesthetically, it's kind of like Inception meets Batman in that poster. Yeah. And like, that's just great. The nerd in me was so happy when I saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that was an accident. Did either of you guys watch the trailer for John Carter?
I have not.
I have not either.
Oh, okay.
We sucked.
Well, yeah, a little bit. You're kind of leaving me on the lurch here. Speaking for myself, I've always been a big fan of Edgar Rice Burroughs. I read the John Carter series as a kid, and it was always something I had dreamed of seeing on the big screen. Next year marks the 100th anniversary since the publication of A Princess of Mars, which is the first book in the series. So it's kind of an amazing little anniversary for this movie to be coming out on. The movie itself, you know, it was just in more of an atmospheric teaser. It didn't really give much away in terms of plotting or even big effect shots. It just was sort of hinting at the world. In terms of how it was cut together, I thought it was pretty effective. It looks beautiful. I was a little annoyed because the trailer really doesn't give any indication of the scope of the movie's setting. There's no mention of the word Mars anywhere in the trailer. And obviously Disney, for reasons I don't understand, has seen fit to remove the title of Mars, to remove the word Mars from the title. Instead, they're calling it just John Carter, which for all I know it's a fucking biopic of Noah Wiley's character from ER. I mean, doesn't really make much sense to me. Andrew Stanton in an interview said that they wanted to kind of they want to emphasize the character as like this titular hero versus sort of the backdrop. I don't fucking understand, because there's nothing in the name John Carter that I think makes people go, holy shit, that's a cool fucking name. What is that about?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That, I mean, because I was unfamiliar with the background of it and what it was. And so when I got the email, like, check out the John Carter trailer, my brain immediately went to John Tucker Must Die. And I didn't watch the damn thing. I'm like, why do I, like, John Carter, yay.
Oh, my God.
It's not an inspiring title.
No, it's not. And I'm really disappointed in Disney's marketing and the movie so far. I didn't like the teaser poster that they did. It was really stupid. Just like a black and white picture of this guy sort of smoldering. I'm like, what? You have like this giant story, this huge epic backdrop, and you're going to show Tyler Kitsch or whatever the hell his name is just kind of looking goofy on the poster? I don't understand. It's bizarre. But I have a lot of faith in Andrew Stanton as a storyteller. The script has had some work done by some great writers like Michael Chabon. I can't really speculate as to whether the work is great yet because I haven't read it. But it's a movie I'm really excited for nonetheless, in spite of the fact that the trailer, to a degree, was underwhelming. How about the trailer for Hugo, the upcoming Martin Scorsese film? Did you guys check that out?
Ooh. I have not, but I'm looking forward to that one.
Ditto.
What are you guys doing?
I literally haven't been watching trailers this week. I did watch a few movies, like I said. I watched Lincoln Lawyer, Page One inside the New York Times.
What you think of those? I saw both of those. What did you think of those movies?
You know, I thought Lincoln Lawyers was kind of, you know, it was a pleasant film. You know, it wasn't, you know, it didn't rattle me in any way. You know, it was enjoyable to watch. Probably won't see it a second time. It was good. Page One, I really like. David Carr, I love that guy. I love when he was in the, with the people from Vice magazine.
Yeah, that's like the best scene. That's the funniest scene in the movie.
Yeah, and that guy makes that ignorant comment about the New York Times. David Carr just stops typing and tells him to go fuck himself.
Yeah. Just because you put on a fucking safari hat doesn't mean you can denigrate what we do.
Yeah. Waits, and then, okay, now continue. he's an interesting guy. Did you see him on Bill Maher? I think it was a week ago.
Yes, I've seen him. He's been making – I mean, he's always kind of been around. I've seen him on Charlie Rose a million times over the years because Charlie Rose always brings him on every time Apple releases a new product to talk about it on the show. So I was already pretty familiar. I read his work at the Times too, but I'd never seen this much of him until I saw this film. And I did see him on Bill Maher. He's a very – he's kind of a polarizing guy to a degree because he's not afraid to just say what he thinks. And he doesn't really give a fuck what people think of him. Which is a powerful thing to have, and I guess for people who are listening and don't know, David Carr is the sort of lead media writer for the New York Times, and he's this kind of very curmudgeonly sort of former
crack addict.
Yeah, recovered crack addict. He's lived life, so to speak. So at this point, I think he's kind of in that frame of mind where he's like, I don't give a fuck. I'm going to do what I need to do and say what I need to say, and it just makes him a very compelling guy to listen to.
And I think a good example of that was on Bill Maher when they were talking about, you know, the announced pullout from Afghanistan, which seemed to be a little, you know, weak to some of the people. And David Carr interrupts dialogue to blurt out with, it reminds me of the pullout I promised the mother of my children. And everybody just like stopped talking.
And no one laughed. I was cracking up. I was like, oh, come on. That was funny.
Yeah. I was right there with you, man. Is also for another thing that I'm really looking forward to at Comic-Con, just because I love the idea. The film looks kind of so-so. Have either of you heard of The Divide?
I haven't heard of that.
It's sort of a, you know, there's like an apocalyptic event in New York, and these eight survivors are trapped in this basement. So, you know, it's one of those kind of claustrophobic tension thriller type movies. Yeah. But the screening at Comic-Con, they're hosting a dungeon screening. So it's going to be like set in this small, dank basement. So you're going to be vicariously living the experience as you watch the film. So I think that's a I think that's a really cool idea, a new way to bring the marketing to the next level. So looking forward to that. And then just it's not movie related, but I cannot wait for the Archer panel. I love that show.
Yes.
I still have yet to see a single episode of Archer, and everyone keeps telling me how great it is.
Oh man, it's all on Netflix. Watch Instant.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
First season. I'm sorry.
I will add it today then, and I will check it out ASAP because I trust both of your tastes, and everyone keeps telling me that this show is something I need to see. So
yeah, there's no doubt in my mind you'll enjoy it.
If we can digress also to TV for the briefest of moments, and I promise our listeners will come back to film. Is anyone checking out Breaking Bad tonight?
Yeah.
I don't have cable.
Breaking Bad is my favorite show on TV, so I've already set my DVR and.
Baby!
It will be watched tonight.
Oh, I'm so excited. I am so pumped up. And it went fast. You know, I remember the finale, for those who don't watch the show, the season 3 finale aired just over a year ago. And it took the writers a while to kind of get back into the writer's room and hash out the next season. And I remember thinking to myself, man, this show is never going to be back on. It's going to take forever. And it's like in the blink of an eye, it's back. Bryan Cranston's bald, beautiful head. I can't wait. I saw Bryan Cranston at the LA Film Festival, and he already had the shaved head and everything, and he had the facial hair. He was there for the LA Film Fest premiere of his movie Drive, which will be out this October from Film District.
Ooh.
Great movie, by the way, for anyone who is looking forward to it. It's fantastic. It stars Ryan Gosling, and Bryan Cranston's one of the co-stars, and he was peeing next to me in the next urinal over. Finished, and it was kind of cool to talk. I said, I just want to let you know, man, like, the movie was fantastic, and your show is it is my favorite show on TV. And he was very gracious. He's like, thank you very much. And then I walked away kind of sheepishly, but it was kind of cool.
Kudos for you for waiting until he zipped it up to talk.
Yeah, I was like waiting, and I was in my head, I'm thinking, oh my god, please don't finish way before me. Please don't finish way before me, because then he would have like walked out. And we finished right around the same time, so it was kind of a very organic opening I had. You know, like I would like he would have left before me, and I would have like turned around while still peeing, like, dude, I love you.
With your member in your hand, that's awkward.
Whipping out the junk.
I'm glad you didn't have a Jake Gyllenhaal moment in the.
No, Jake Gyllenhaal moment here.
What? What's that?
Was it South by Southwest, Michael?
Yeah, I think it was South by Southwest.
Yeah, Jake Gyllenhaal punched a guy in the bathroom.
How did I not hear about this?
Yeah, really, I'm surprised you didn't.
Yeah, I think it was right after the Source Code premiere. There, he was being harassed in the back. I don't blame him. You know, if some guy's like annoying the shit out of you, he won't get out of your face. I sympathize to a certain degree with some of these movie stars. They can't go anywhere without getting harassed. It gets really annoying after a while. Like, you just, and I feel like they would never punch a person who was being cool. They're only going to punch people who are being dicks or being really like aggressive and in their face. If you go up to any movie star and just say, you know, I'm really a big fan of your work, and you don't act like a blithering idiot, they're going to be fine. But some of these people don't know how to handle their shit.
I don't. Maybe he just told him what he thought of the Source Code.
Jake, I really liked it, man, but that ending, that denouement, made no fucking sense.
Boom!
Yeah. What? I was in Donnie Darko, motherfucker. I know about endings that make no sense. Come here. So,
I'm a sci-fi buff, and I liked it better when you were balling cowboys. Just saying.
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to read that article I sent you, Justin? The one with James Franco.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought that was really revealing. Basically, you know, it was James Franco kind of finally gave the dish on his bizarre performance as host of the Oscars. And there were a few things in the article that I found really interesting, like the fact that Steven Spielberg allegedly said that was the best Oscars ever after the performance. Which, if true, kind of you know, I tend to. For those of you out there who don't know me, I tend to think of Spielberg as very overrated, and I think if he said that, it proves my statement. But the main thing I found interesting was that, you know, he was talking about, you know, well, he just hated the writing. He thought, you know, the stuff they wanted him to do sounded really stupid, and so he just kind of went out there and half-assed it because he didn't care. But he had talked about you know, Apatow had came in and did some writing for the skits, and they just didn't use it. And I think, you know, I think that's really what's wrong with these Academy Awards, that they're letting these people, you know, write these horrible sketches and dialogues and let Hollywood do it. Man, if you have Judd Apatow coming in, like, yeah, I'll write it. Please do. There's a reason why these filmmakers are being honored and the people writing for the Oscars are not.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I wonder if the Apatow material was too edgy or something and that they were afraid of it. Because I can't imagine he wrote something that wasn't at all funny. I mean, he is funny. So I just wonder if the content was a bit too edgy for that particular broadcast. I mean, Franco seems to be a guy with okay taste, and he thought it was funny. So
yeah. I just think, you know, that's something they should consider experimenting with in the future. You know, get some people from Hollywood to come in. And hell, then you could market it that way, you know? The Academy Awards, you know, written by so-and-so.
Yeah, because nobody can name a single writer in the Academy Awards with the sole possible exception, I think, of Bruce Vilanch, which if you know the Oscars, you know who Bruce Vilanch is. He's that big, fat guy who looks like a constipated teddy bear or something.
Have you ever seen the first attempt at a Masters of Universe movie with Dolph Lundgren?
I saw it when I was a kid, but I can't remember any of it.
Do you remember that short furry face thing?
No.
In the movie?
No.
Justin, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
That's Bruce.
I mean, he's been at it forever with writing the Academy Awards, and, you know, he's come up with some good jokes in his time. It's not as though the man's never said anything funny, but I think that's actually a great idea, Will. Like, if you could get a top-notch comedy guy to come in and do a lot of the writing and then just, you know, make that part of the spin. Just say, come watch, you know, the opening monologue is written by, yeah, Judd Apatow. I think that would be enticing for people. People would be curious to tune into that, at least a little more than they are now.
Yeah, you know, that would be an interesting list to come up with, like, directors, you know, like, you know, 2012 Academy Awards directed by Quentin Tarantino.
Well, I mean, they always have a pretty well-known producer producing them. You know, they've had Adam Shankman, and they had Bruce Cohen, who did, like, American Beauty. Mm-hmm. So they do, but no one knows who producers are, so I guess that's not as exciting to people.
Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying, like, you know, how weird could that get? You know, like a Quentin Tarantino directed Oscars or David Lynch or...
Yeah. I would be super, super excited to be able to see stuff like that. But that would be, I don't know. Maybe that's too niche for middle America. I don't know.
Well, they need to come up with something because it's not working.
It's dying, right? It's dying on the vine. What do you guys think of the sliding scale they're using this year for the Best Picture nominations?
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're – okay, so for those who are listening and don't know, this year – instead of just having a 10 best pictures by default nominated, they are going to be using a kind of sliding scale, meaning a movie cannot be nominated for best picture unless it receives a certain percentage of votes as best picture by those voting for the nominations, which means there could be anything from between 5 and 10 nominations. So one year we might have 6, one year we might have 9, and it really depends on how passionate people are about voting for those particular movies. And I'm not sure yet how that's going to work out, but it might actually make the Academy Award nominations into a bit more of a meritocracy, since there's always a nomination or two, especially in the last couple of years, that we all know would never be on there if it wasn't for the quantity of nominations.
Yeah, but at the same time, that could just open up the process to even more lobbying.
Very true. Very, very true.
You know, like, hey, vote for this, you know, so we can get, you know, this number of votes. I think this is exactly what I'm talking about. You know, instead of coming up with these really weird gimmicks, like, oh, now we're going to introduce a sliding scale or this, you know, just bring in talented people.
Yeah.
You know, people will watch it. People still, like, we still tune in year after year and watch it even though we know it's going to suck. Like, you have our attention. So just create something that's going to be enjoyable. Don't come up with these weird nomination gimmicks, you know? I mean, what's next? Yeah. I mean, what's next? Are they going to turn into American Idol? Now you can vote for Best Picture. Just text your response to...
Yeah,
I guess they could treat the Academy Awards almost like they treat the opening ceremony at the Olympics. Like they get some big guy like Zhang Yimou or Danny Boyle to do something big and spectacular. They could kind of do the same thing, at least with the beginning of the show or in kind of the layout of the show, something like that. And then just spin it that way. Maybe something like that could work. That's actually a really interesting idea. For those listening, we'd love to hear your comments, what you think about that as well.
So this was the week of Harry Potter, pretty much. It's shattering records left and right, and it was the conclusion to the entire film franchise. This is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, and we actually got a voicemail regarding this movie and this podcast. So thank you to my friend Adele, who lives all the way over across the pond in Australia, guys. Is that a term, across the pond for Australia? But anyway, here's Adele's thoughts. Thank you, Adele, for sending this in.
Hi, Justin. It's Adele here. You can use this if you want, but if you don't, then so be it. I just wanted to talk to you about Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, which I saw here in Australia nearly 24 hours ago. I found it to be a really fitting conclusion to a long, long series. Of course, a lot of people didn't probably get enough attention, but I think everyone would feel that way about their favourite characters, although Ron could have had more lines and the Snog could have been a lot longer, I think. My favourite had to be Maggie Smith. She's just a delight on screen, and anytime she comes on, I just like, oh, love her. I also think that Alan Rickman as Snape finally got some great stuff to do, and I really, really enjoyed it. On the other hand, as someone who's been to many, many midnight screenings, this is quite possibly the most annoying one I've ever been to. Not because people are excited, but because I had a sobber behind me. For the last hour of the movie, all I could hear was this. Like the whole last hour. I've never wanted to hurt someone so much in a theatre in my entire life. And also people cheered in anticipation of a line, so they couldn't actually hear the line reading. So when Molly Weasley says that fantastic line to Bellatrix, you couldn't hear it because people were already cheering, which kind of sucked. But I loved it, and I plan on seeing it again the next probably 48 hours, and I hope you enjoyed it too. So cheers from Australia. Bye.
Mr. Merlob, you and I both got a chance to see the film. I wanted to know, I'm curious, what is your kind of history with the Harry Potter series?
You know, I'm sorry to say that it's a book series I kind of missed the boat on. You know, when the books were becoming really popular, I was, you know, in college, and I just never quite got into that mode, that groove of reading them, even whilst everybody else seemed to be getting super into them, and it was really exploding into this worldwide phenomenon. I'm a big reader. I read a lot of stuff, but I just never read these books. That being said, I have seen all the films now, and speaking only from the perspective of someone that's experienced the movies, because my understanding from those who have read the books is that the books are significantly better, even as well made as some of the movies are. The books obviously have much more of a richness to them that you're just not going to get in a two and a half hour running time. So with that in mind, I have to admit I've never been a huge fan of this film series. I say that more from a subjective place than an objective place, meaning I think many of the films in this series are well-made movies. I just don't have a particular affinity for them. This is largely because, maybe it's because I haven't read the book, so I just don't have the educational background to be able to focus on them and follow them, as, you know, I have to spend 1 to 2 years between each movie. So every time I have to watch a new movie in this series, I feel like I'm playing catch-up because I don't remember what happened in the last one. But I find them to be a little overstuffed plot-wise. I find them to... The Harry Potter movies, I find them to not... they're a bit inelegant to me, I guess is the word I would use. When I say inelegant, I mean in terms of like the narrative flow of these movies, they feel kind of lurching. It's like they lurch from plot point A to plot point B to plot point C. And even though they do build up these characters over the course of the series and they get some great character moments in there, I find the actual plots to be sort of exhausting. It's just like this endless cavalcade of events that happen. And I have a hard time sort of being really invested in them. Again, maybe this is because I'm watching the movies spread so far apart, but I've never really gotten that into them. To me, the best film in the series has been the third film, The Prisoner of Azkaban, which was the one that was directed by Alfonso Cuarón. I thought that one had the most interesting mixture of sort of characterization and sort of an intriguing mystery involving David Thewlis's character, who is a werewolf. And I just thought it was really interestingly shot. I thought Cuarón put in all these little bits sort of referencing puberty and like pubescent kids and stuff that was just sort of under the surface, but made it sort of more interesting. As terms of this latest one, well, we'll get into that, but that's sort of my take on the series as a whole. I've never been a huge fan of the series, but I do regard them as being largely well made, with the exception of the first two, which the Chris Columbus entries I don't think are that impressive. But after that, the series really picked up. I think David Yates, who's directed the last four installments, I guess if you're counting the both parts of Deathly Hallows, he's done a good job kind of bringing it to a close. He's a good working man's director, like a good journeyman filmmaker, which is why I think Warner Brothers was comfortable with him bringing the series to a conclusion. And they're well-made films, but I've never been a huge fan of the Harry Potter series. Well, what about you?
You know, I haven't seen the current one, but I've seen all the rest. And I think, you know, I share a lot of the same thoughts. You know, they're really well-crafted movies. But for me, it just seems that, you know, it's almost the same story each movie. You know, oh, hey, who's the new teacher for dark arts? Oh, that's the person who's the bad guy. Then there's this, you know, end conflict, and then it resolves, and, you know, everybody goes home, the school year's over, and it's just, you know, hey, we'll be on pause until next. Like, I didn't know evil was on such a well-regulated schedule that it, you know, coincides with the school year. My other problems is I've always felt like the endings were always anticlimactic. It feels like there's just this build up, and then it never really pays off. And the other problem is I've never really felt emotionally invested in any of it, because it's so obvious that all is going to turn out, you know, there's really no big twist to, you know, make you think anything otherwise. Harry's going to be okay. He's going to win. And so I think that, you know, hinders a person's ability to, you know, really get in and feel the ups and downs emotionally, because we know exactly where it's going from the beginning.
Yeah. I have a similar thought on these. I've never been a huge Harry Potter fan. I've watched all of the films. I read the first book, but after that, when they started going into the 500, 700 page, I was like, all right, I'm not going to read that. I don't have time to read that. So I've watched all of the films, and I've always felt like an outsider into the world of Harry Potter. It's always been a huge cultural thing, and we see that with the ending of the series here. You see how many Harry Potter fans there are throughout the world. And I went to the theme park a couple months ago and got a chance to ride the ride and see all of the different attractions there, and it just didn't do that much for me because I just had never been invested in the world of Harry Potter. And the thing that I like about this movie, Deathly Hallows Part 2, is, like, Will, what you were saying about how each of the installments, it just felt like it was the yearly Harry Potter film, and it just kept going and going and going. Mm-hmm. Whereas this one, I feel like there's a definite conclusion to the storyline. So I enjoyed that more than anything of, okay, we're done. There's not, you know, there's not going to be the next year of this happening again. You know, so I really enjoyed that part about it. And Michael, what you were saying about the plots, I did enjoy the line that they had in this movie. And for all I know, it could be in the book as well. But the one where Harry's talking about, when do any of our plots ever work? You know, we just go there and do that, and then everything turns out bad. Like, basically is the line that he gave. So I really enjoyed that kind of referencing their past endeavors and being aware of, you know what, none of our plots ever work. So let's just go in there and try to take this guy out. So I liked that aspect of it. And it's really, you know, if you're listening to this and you're interested, then you've probably seen all of the movies before and you're probably a Harry Potter fan, because it doesn't work at all as a standalone movie, and it's not trying to. But if you're just going in and seeing part two of this, then you're going to be lost if you haven't if you're not familiar with the world of Harry Potter. So I think we're pretty much talking to a specific audience right now. And the part one was one of my least favorite of the Harry Potter movies. I felt like it was too long. It didn't go anywhere. And it was hard to judge it because I knew it was a part one of a two series. So judging it as a standalone movie was hard to do. I'm interested to go back and watch them together because I haven't seen part one since it came out in the theater, and seeing how they connect to each other as one long film. But overall, I enjoyed myself. I'm not a huge Harry Potter fan, so I couldn't tell you all of the side characters, and I couldn't tell you this from that. A lot of the stuff that they referenced from other movies, I'm sure I missed what some of the inside jokes were or whatever. There was girls crying around me and people clapping at moments that I had no idea what they were clapping at. So,
yeah, I have rarely, I'm not sure in my life I've ever seen a movie where people were as into it as this one. I went to a Thursday at midnight screening. I was sort of dragged there by my wife, who's a huge fan of the series. And every time for the past like 6 months, every fucking time we drove by a billboard of Harry Potter in LA, she would squeal every time. So she's been really excited, psyched up for that. She's seen it 3 times now. She loves it. Yeah, I know, right? For this particular film, I do think it's one of the better entries in the series. I wouldn't say it's the best movie in the series. Like I said, I still think that's Cuarón's part three. But it's a good movie. It's well shot. It's fine on a technical level. Again, it's got a little bit of that lurchy plot thing. They're just like running around getting these horcruxes at the end. I mean, it's like just scene after scene of just they go point A, point B, point C, da da da. I mean, and some people would call that a fast, breathless pace. But to me, it feels more like ADD. I don't know. It doesn't feel like there's no elegance to like the flow of the plot. It's just sort of thudding from point A to point B, and then finally to the, you know, expected epic battle at the end. Without giving too much away, yes, the ending's emotionally satisfying, especially to those who have kind of really been along with this series, which I imagine is most of the audience. The acting is solid all around. I've never found any of the three kid actors to be particularly amazing actors. They've all been more than serviceable. In particular, Daniel Radcliffe has always done a good job in this role, but it's not like it's ever been a role that blew me away, either in the writing or in his acting. So maybe it's not entirely his fault. I have a real respect for Daniel Radcliffe because it feels like he takes acting seriously. The guy's always trying to do interesting stage work. Seems like he's always trying to like push his craft to the next level. I think that's really respectable because he could easily be coasting off this role and doing other like big movies or big lousy projects. He's not, doesn't seem to be doing that. So I think he deserves a little bit of acclaim and recognition for that. I think the best thing in the movie is probably Ralph Fiennes, who plays the villain Voldemort. There's a certain deliciousness to his performance that makes it really fun and sinister and creepy. He plays Voldemort as this like he's a pretty chill dude because he knows he's got all the power. Like he's confident but not cocky, and he just kind of saunters around. That being said, for anyone who has seen this movie now, I'm sure you'll realize he's like one of the best characters in the series. He's the best character in this movie, and he spends half the movie standing on a fucking hill looking at Hogwarts. Like, he literally spends half the fucking movie standing on a hill looking at Hogwarts going, Harry, the boy will die. You go down there and do it. Like, it's just sort of – and the movies, they've always done this kind of stuff. Like, these kind of artificially long segues and moments. For example, in the last film, the Deathly Hallows Part 1, 3/4 of that movie was them sitting in the woods, not doing anything.
Yeah.
And I understand why they split this book in two, and I think it works, but you know what I mean? Like, it's a little exhausting. I find these movies exhausting. That's a good word for it. Like, I come out of these movies, and I'm fucking drained. And I don't mean emotionally. I'm just drained with having to kind of sit there and follow them. And I'm just like, what the hell, man? And I know they're well-made, and I understand why people love this series. I really do, and I respect that. It's cool. If it's your thing, I get it. I'm obviously in the minority here because every person on the planet, except apparently a few people in the fucking Congo, have read these books and love them. So I know I'm on the lone side of the fence here, but that's fine. I'm just not a huge fan of the series. And like Justin said, when this movie was over, I actually breathed a sigh of relief. Not because this particular film was over, because the series is finally fucking finished. Like, no more movies. Don't have to have my RSS feeds and for all the film sites clogged up anymore with breathless set photos of Daniel Radcliffe standing next to a fucking stone wall looking the same as he has in all the other movies. Like, I don't have to deal with that anymore. So I'm sort of relieved. So Harry Potter, you know, God bless. Goodbye. It's been nice knowing you. Yeah. You've given me a couple of thrills over the years, but it's been more of a pleasant tea time, to use the British term. I'm glad to see you go.
You know, first of all, I'd like to give you brownie points for managing to work the Republic of Congo into that rant. Secondly, I mean, as much money as this thing is making, I mean, it just ousted The Dark Knight for highest weekend opening ever. Do we really honestly think this is going to be the end? I mean, come on. I'm willing to bet right now $1,000 that in 2 years we're going to hear about the production of Harry Potter, The Rise of Voldemort.
No!
Where it tells the story of how Voldemort came, you know, went to the dark side and killed Harry Potter's parents. That's going to happen.
Well, you're right. I wouldn't be surprised if J.K. Rowling, I know you listen to this show, so I'm going to say this to you. You got enough money, babe. You're like the richest woman on earth after Oprah, I think.
Yeah.
Just take a chill pill, hon. You can do something else. Go work on a different book. You're a really talented writer. Leave. Let sleeping dogs lie. Please, please, for the love of God, don't write another book. You're not living in a van anymore. You don't need the money. You can do whatever you want. Please do something else.
Harry Potter, the college years.
J.K. Rowling sitting in like her house right now. She's like, I used to like this show, but I'm not going to listen to this anymore.
I mean, it's definitely not over. I remember just, you know, at the end of June, there was a story came out that J.K. Rowling had this, you know, mysterious new Harry Potter website.
Yes. And it's Pottermore or something.
Yeah. Pottermore.
Oh, God, more. Not more.
Yeah, I don't know about this being the end or not. I hope it is, but like you said, Will, it's definitely, if they're going to go off, Warner Brothers wants to continue to milk it for all they can. I'm sure they'll re-release it into the theaters and we'll see all these things again.
I mean, can you honestly not see the Rise of Voldemort being a possibility?
Yes, I can.
The Clone Wars syndrome, yeah.
You're right. For our listeners who like this kind of stuff, who like books about magic, and I do have a book recommendation. This is by no means a new book. It's been out for years, but for those who haven't read it, it's fantastic. It's called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. It's this epic book written by Susanna Clarke, and it's sort of this world where we're in London around the time when Napoleon was king of France, and it sort of takes place during the Napoleonic Wars, and it's this very realistic backdrop to the magic. Like, it's a world where magic hasn't been seen in a long time, but there's this guy, Mr. Norrell, who practices magic, and Jonathan Strange, who's this young wannabe magician, and it's like a really adult, epic, almost more realistic take on Harry Potter to a degree. So for people who like the Harry Potter books and are looking for something new, I would really recommend Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. You can easily get it in hardcover paperback from Amazon, as well as in Kindle form for those who like to read it on their e-readers. It's a great book. So that's something I would encourage people to go out and seek out.
Yeah, Michael, you talked about kind of the actors, and throughout the series, Daniel Radcliffe hasn't really done anything for me. Neither has Rupert Grint. But I think Emma Watson is going to – I was just thinking about it the other day. Like, after Harry Potter and let's hope there is no more after this, but what are the film careers going to be like for these three young actors that we met 10 years ago, which is, it's really interesting to go back and watch that first movie and see them age throughout this. But Emma Watson, I think, has the most potential for having a career after Harry Potter. So I'm going to be interested to see what she does next after this. But the two things I will say about the Harry Potter series, like I said, I've never been a huge Harry Potter fan, but the two things that I can take away from these eight movies is, number one, the score and the theme that John Williams created in the first movie that he hasn't done all the scores for all the movies, but it's still that theme of Harry Potter has resonated throughout and comes up again in this latest movie. But that is John Williams, one of my favorite composers of all time. So him creating another memorable theme upon the millions that he's created previously, that will always stick with me. And then the cast, they've had some amazing actors. You talked about Voldemort and Ralph Fiennes, Michael, just the amount of people that have been, if you just would name off the cast from these eight movies, it's been a veritable who's who's of British actors and American actors, just some great people throughout this. And you just look at the cast for this movie, if you're looking at the end credits, you can just point out just, oh, there's a good actor, there's a good actor, there's a good actor. So I've really enjoyed the casts of these movies. Haven't enjoyed the plots of all the movies, but the casts, I think, have stood out to me throughout all of the Harry Potter movies.
Absolutely. They've had pretty much every respectable British actor, except
even that Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Yeah. For real, David Tennant came on. That was great. You know.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm sorry, Will, are you going to be seeing part two anytime soon?
Yeah, I haven't seen a single Harry Potter film in the theater. Oh, I've always waited for DVD, so I'll probably go see this one. But I've seen so many people like on Facebook and Twitter putting out pictures of the 3D glasses being, are those like commonplace, or is that just, you know, for like the special midnight opening, the rounded?
I think they're commonplace. I don't know, Michael, about your theater, but mine, I went to see it at an IMAX theater, and they have special IMAX glasses, but you could see on the side, they still had the special Harry Potter 3D glasses for the normal showings. Mm-hmm. So I think just anywhere that has a 3D showing of it is going to have those special Harry Potter glasses.
Yeah, because my question is, you know, I'm one of those people who has to wear the 3D glasses over my other glasses.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that's going to work with the round ones. I mean, am I like going to be watching the movie through a pair of fucking binoculars? Like,
yeah.
Well, what? I mean, you might want to try to seek it out in 2D then. There have been a couple of, like here in LA, there were a couple of theaters showing it in 2D. Most of them, it is 3D. And for those who are wondering, this is a movie that went through a post-conversion process for the 3D, but I mean, the 3D was fine. It didn't bug me. It didn't hurt my eyes or anything like that. I'm not a fan of the format in general, but, you know, it worked fine. I wouldn't say it's one of those must-see 3D experiences, but most of you aren't going to have a choice, so don't be too worried that the 3D is going to look like crap. It doesn't. They did a good job. They handled it carefully. But, Will, if you're worried about the 3D glasses, you could always try to find it in 2D. There might be a theater or two in your city.
Yeah, I saw it in 3D as well, but with the IMAX, I don't think it's playing in 2D. I think all the IMAX are 3D as far as I know. So I didn't really have a choice. And I'm like, Michael, it didn't bother me. It didn't stand out to me, but it was better than a lot of the post-converted 3D movies I've seen. So,
Clash of the Titans.
Yeah. You won't have that type of experience with Harry Potter. So I would recommend IMAX. It's, to me, IMAX, if you can, I would say that's my preferred option, because it's pretty much, you're going to get the best visual quality. You're going to get the best audio quality. It is a steeper price, but if you can afford it and if you have it in your area, I think IMAX is the way to go for me. And they played a lot of, they only play IMAX trailers beforehand. And I don't, as we said earlier in the show, I don't watch trailers, but I did see a little sneak of the Mission Impossible movie that's coming out at the end of this year. And I didn't realize that there are actually scenes filmed with IMAX cameras for that new Mission Impossible movie.
That movie looks... I mean, look, I wouldn't exactly say I'm thrilled to see a fourth entry in the Mission Impossible series, but, you know, that being said, it looks kind of cool. It's got some nice little visual shots in there. I'm mostly just excited to see it because I want to see what Brad Bird does with live action.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, he's such a good filmmaker, and it's a really interesting little experiment to see if his sensibilities can really translate to the big screen in a live action film. So super excited and intrigued about that.
Yeah. And that Mission Impossible series has kind of been like the Alien series, where each one, there was a new director, a new style, and there was something different to it. And you don't necessarily have to have seen the previous Mission Impossible movies. There's some things that have a through line, but for the most part, they're almost standalone movies on each one of them. So like you, Michael, I'm interested to see what Brad Bird does with it. And I want to see, anytime something is shot with IMAX cameras, I always want to see it in an IMAX format. Ever since The Dark Knight, I've always tried to do that. So definitely I will be checking that out. And if anyone has checked out Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, let us know. You can always email us at flicksofdoom@gmail.com, or you can go on Twitter and tweet us, twitter.com/flicksofdoom. And hopefully you enjoyed our new format and new setup for the show. And you can leave some comments over at geeksofdoom.com as well. Mr. Merlob and Mr. Melton, thank you for joining me again, my friends.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And we'll see you guys next week on Flicks of Doom.